greetings, my friend. We are all interested in the future, for that is where you and I are going to spend the rest of our lives. And remember, my friend, future events such as these will affect you in the future. You are interested in the unknown, the mysterious, the unexplainable. That is why you are here. And now, for the first time, we are bringing to you the full story of what happened on that fateful day. We are giving you all the evidence based only on the secret testimony of the miserable souls who survived this terrifying ordeal. The incidents, the places. My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer. Let us punish the guilty. Let us reward the innocent. My friend, can your heart stand the shocking facts about
Radio Mysterioso?
Hey, it's Radio Mysterioso. As promised, tonight we have Sesh Hari, who is author of Wonder of the Worlds, Metamorphosis, Handprint of Atlas, and a forthcoming volume, the third in the Wonder of the Worlds trilogy, if I'm getting that right. Can you hear me, Sesh?
Yes, I can. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
Yes, you have that right. There are two of the trilogy out right now, or they're in the process of getting out. Wonder of the Worlds, the first novel, and then the second one is Metamorphosis. And the third one I'm just in the process of completing, and I should have that done hopefully in about another just a few weeks if things go to plan. But so tonight, you know, we can talk about Wonder of the Worlds and Metamorphosis and the Handprint of Atlas too. We'll get into that if you want to.
Okay, excellent, because the only one of those I've read is Wonder of the Worlds.
Yeah, okay.
Which I've read 1.5 times, meaning I read first time, and then I went through and selected sections that I really liked and revisited it, because I really liked that book.
Thanks for that half extra read.
I appreciate it. You know what? I'm going to take it with me when I go to New Mexico this next week and read it through again, because I really enjoyed it.
Well, thank you very much, Greg. I wanted to tell you, you know, you're having an impact in popular culture. I don't know if you're aware of that or not. Do you know that your book, Weird California?
Yeah.
It's now the theme of the California State Fair. Did you know that?
Because of the book, or are they featuring it?
You know,
or?
They don't actually come right out and say it's your book, but it's quite obvious. They call it the weird, wild, and wacky California. And all the places in your book are featured at the California State Fair as a paranormal theme this year. They have things like Bigfoot displays and UFOs. And it's your book, you know. It's the idea of your book. And I think whoever organized the fair must have been inspired by your book. And because there it is, you know, it's just like your book, and pretty good fair. I was there the other night, and you know, they had some interesting exhibits. And if anybody in Northern California is interested in the paranormal, you know, take a trip up to Sacramento. The fair's open tomorrow, and it'd be worth the trip for them. They have a tremendous performance there by a group called the Fire Pixies. They do now they take fire eating to a whole new level. It's really a circus. It's three people. It's a man and two beautiful women, a brunette and a blonde, and they do fire eating, juggling, trapeze. They combine modern dance and stage magic, and this is a full show. Now, they come into the audience, and they actually do tricks with the fire right among the audience. And they even put the fire down people's throats, if you can imagine that. This is incredible. It was one of the most amazing performances I've ever seen. And so, you know, it's quite a fair they have this year. And I've been influenced by Fares all my life, you know, and that's what really led to me writing Wonder of the Worlds, because for many years I wanted to write a novel set in a fair or a world's fair or a giant theme park, and it was a very vague idea, and it took a long time for it to coalesce into a reality, because there were a lot of threads that went into eventually what became Wonder of the Worlds. Of course, there's Nikola Tesla, and I learned about him in 1991, so that I'd been thinking about this fair novel, you know, for a long time before then. And all of these things began coming to, but the fair idea was there from the beginning. And so the trilogy, this Wonder of the Worlds trilogy, is actually structured along the fairs. It involves three great world's fairs: the Columbian Exposition of 1893, the Chicago World's Fair, that's where Wonder of the Worlds is set.
Right.
And then in Metamorphosis, it's set in 1915, and it's set at the Panama Pacific Exhibition in San Francisco. And the final novel that I'm writing now is set, well, it part of it occurs at the New York World's Fair of 1939. So you have these three great World's Fairs placed in time approximately equidistantly apart, and they define in a way the development of technology in the world and the development of sociological phenomenon. So that's a real big driving thing there with this trilogy of novels. It is the fair, and the state fair for me is kind of the beginning of it, because California State Fair, from childhood, the old California State Fair was based upon the Chicago World's Fair of 1893. In fact, the California exhibit at the Chicago Fair was brought back here, and that's what they based the basic county building on here at the old fair.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I was kind of into that from childhood, but didn't quite understand what it was all about, you know, but there was a feeling there that was like a seed that slowly grew.
Well, the first novel, maybe you should give some people background, sort of maybe an outline of what happens in it, because, you know, who would think to take Nikola Tesla, Mark Twain, Harry Houdini, who I guess a couple of those characters make appearances in either both or all three novels, and then other people don't know about, like, was it George Ade was the journalist? Yeah, who was an incredibly great writer, actually. He was sort of like a newspaper man and humorist.
Yes,
and all these characters.
There's a whole story about George Ade we could talk about, too, because he's just about completely forgotten today. And the only way I knew about George Ade was I had studied Mark Twain extensively for many years, and somewhere along in my research, I had come across a little bit about a writer named George Ade, who Mark Twain was making some comment on, and that stuck in my head. And so the name was there, and I associated it with Mark Twain. But when I got around to writing Wonder of the Worlds, I had the plot line pretty well worked out, and I knew I was going to be using historical characters, and the main characters, I already had those in mind. They were Nikola Tesla, who most of your listeners probably know all about Nikola Tesla, people talking about him. He's probably the greatest inventor of all time. He invented the alternating current system of electricity that allows us to have our electrical civilization. And he also did some really far out things with technology later on, and became completely forgotten to most people. He was my main character, and obviously he's a perfect character for a science fiction novel. And then I found out that he knew Mark Twain, and I've been studying Mark Twain for many, many years, and I played Mark Twain on riverboats and in summer stock and in historical theaters. I toured with this show. It was very much like Hal Holbrook's one-man Mark Twain Tonight. I did my own research. I went down to the Mark Twain archives at University of California, Berkeley. I did original research there and researched some at UC Davis and other libraries. And I put my show together gradually over many years and did it commercially. And I even did some television commercials representing different newspapers and airlines and that kind of thing. So I knew all about Mark Twain, but I didn't know that anything about Nikola Tesla. To show how repressed and suppressed and forgotten Tesla is, you know, that I had studied Twain for 20 years, and I hadn't heard anything about Tesla or read anything about Tesla. It turns out they knew each other very, very well. And as I learned more about this, I said, this is a great idea for a novel or a movie. And that was the story that I, of Wonder of the Worlds. Something happens to Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla at the Chicago World's Fair of 1893. And what's interesting about it is that Mark Twain actually was in Chicago in 1893 at the World's Fair. And he was there on business, but he visited with Tesla. And also, he was in bed sick for 11 days. And I saw that as a ripe opportunity to do an alternative history there and say, well, what if he really wasn't sick all that time? What if that was just a cover for something else? And that is what Wonder of the Worlds is about, this secret adventure that Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla go on. And involved in that is Harry Houdini, the magician, who was also in Chicago at that time performing at the World's Fair. And then I had the idea, I wanted to bring in some newspaper reporters. And, of course, you know, you want a romantic plot line. So I said, well, you got to have a man and a woman newspaper reporter. And so I started doing research on that and found out that there was only one woman reporter in Chicago at that time that would really fit. There really was only one woman reporter per se. And it got to be very interesting. I did a presentation at David Childress's Kempton event for Adventures Unlimited, and I talk about this. He's got a DVD out on it if anybody's interested. I talk about how, as I started to research this historical woman newspaper reporter, that the story I had already written started to just fall right into place because she really was this type of person. Her characteristics I had already imagined were there. It started getting pretty weird. People have to see the DVD to see what I'm talking about. Well, the same thing happened with the man newspaper reporter. I started looking for somebody to fit that bill, that character. And I had a couple of them in mind. And I finally settled on George Ade. I felt he was the right age, and I got to researching him, and I found out, yeah, he knew Lily West. This was the historical woman newspaper reporter. Yeah. And I started researching him, and I began to uncover some really amazing things, you know, that, you know, he was writing these little science fiction short stories way back in the 1890s, you know, about... they were all burlesques on these boy adventure stories with science fiction themes. And he had these guys running around with levitating electric bicycles, shooting ray guns. And he called them ray guns. Huh. And all kind of stuff like that, you know. And that started boggling my mind. I said, this has got to be it. George Ade's the guy. And then I found out, well, wait a minute. George Ade was a gigantic fan of Mark Twain, and he formed something called the Mark Twain Club in later years. And then I found out that he had met Mark Twain and visited with him, and there was a little bit of a relationship there. And so I said, well, this is it. This is the guy I've been looking for. And this kind of illustrates my whole approach to writing, per se, in fiction, because I call myself a fantastic realist. My books have been marketed as science fiction or pulp science fiction, adventure literature, that kind of thing. And I don't really have any objection to that because, you know, I like pulp fiction and I like Edgar Rice Burroughs and all that. But really, what I'm writing is something quite different, but it looks superficially like it's pulp fiction or pulp science fiction of the old days. It's meant to look like that. It's meant to have that feel. But underneath that is a completely different kind of fiction I'm writing. And there are a few people that have kind of written in this genre a little bit. And the one person that comes to mind, just off the top of my head, is Whitley Strieber. Not all of his work, but one particular one called Majestic, and I'm sure you're familiar with that.
One of my favorites, actually. I think it's actually my favorite Whitley Strieber UFO-connected novel because he can say what he wants to say based on actual things he has found out, you know, historical, well, I don't know if you want to call them facts or not, but things that have come out in the UFO literature and otherwise, and then mixed in with his own, obviously, his own ideas and his experience, and this is exactly what you did.
Right. And although he's writing in 1947, it's still the basic idea, what I call fantastic realism, is this is literature that is real, but it is fantastic because in mainstream realism, let's say somebody like Ernest Hemingway or John Steinbeck, they're using a conventional model of reality to write their fiction. They're saying, this is real, and this is the way we view reality. You know, it's a consensus reality that the mainstream public accepts as real. It doesn't mean that that is reality, but that's the way people perceive reality. So that's what's called realism. But in fantastic realism, the writer presents what he thinks is reality, and it's a model that's separate from the mainstream view. And he's saying to the reading public, the background in this is basically real, but if you look at it from a conventional point of view, it looks unreal. It looks like it's a fantasy story, but it's based on real things. And this is exactly what all of my fictional writing is. Everything I've written so far and everything I'm probably ever going to write, because I do have a different view of reality than other people do. It's not the model of the mainstream view of reality. And so I would inevitably have to write this way. And so in Wonder of the Worlds, there are some things there that are background, and people would read that and say, well, did that really happen, or did you make that up? You know, which part of this did you make up, or which part of this is weird, and yet it's true? And that's part of the fun of reading my novels, or I hope that's the fun of it. And I also think that the more that people are aware of some of these things, the more they're going to enjoy my novels. You know, the more you know about the history of UFOs, or the more you know about Nikola Tesla, or Houdini, or Marconi, the more you will kind of get a kick out of it, because you'll say, wow, that part's real, but nobody believe it, you know, I know that part is at least plausible because I know about some other things that are it's pretty sure that they're real, you know. And so in Wonder of the Worlds, I weave in all kinds of things, the Tesla technology, the claims that he discovered anti-gravity, the claims that he designed airships, or that he actually built airships, or that there was some connection to him and the airships of the 1890s, the free energy. In fact, in Wonder of the Worlds, the main focus of the whole novel is free energy. The story is that Nikola Tesla has discovered a way to take quartz crystal and embed it with monatomic gold, and then use that as a kind of a transducer to draw out of the ether electricity, and can draw it out in unlimited amounts. How much of that is true? Well, I think maybe a lot more than people might think. You know, the more you look into things like monatomic gold and the things David Hudson did with it, and the properties of quartz crystal and piezoelectricity, you begin to look at all that and say, well, that's not too far-fetched. You know, maybe that could have been done. And then the question is, did Tesla do that? Well, using quartz is very close to radio technology and all of that, and Tesla's experiments with electricity and dielectric properties of different kinds of material, and we begin to see that it's not so far-fetched. And you look into things like Townsend Brown's graviditors and that stuff, and then you begin to say, well, okay, let's just say that at least it's plausible. And if you just know that much, it's a lot of fun to read the book. But I go to different levels. It depends on who's reading the book and what their level of knowledge is. I try to write for a broad audience so that, on one level, you can read it as an adventure story if you want to. Another level, you might be into the technology. And then there are other levels involving things like the secret histories of the world and political conspiracies and the secret history of our universe and our solar system and our galaxy. You know, so there are a lot of different levels to it, but they're all there's all kinds of things out there that tend to argue that this is not fantasy. This might at least might be reality. So that's what Wonder of the Worlds is all about, and that's what the trilogy is about.
Yeah, the first book was really made me want to read the second one. Like I said, I went back and read parts of it, especially the end, because there's a lot of stuff you were talking about working on different levels. I think the last chapter, that level you're talking about that's not the exoteric, meaning the one that most people would know about, falls away, and the esoteric becomes very obvious to people that are looking for that kind of stuff. And I know I didn't get all the hints out of it, but that's why I found it to be, you know, one of the reasons why I found it to be a really enjoyable book was that there are hints in there for the seeker to go a little bit further and look for what's coming in the next book. If people are, you know, haven't read the book, is there any way you can synopsize it a little bit without giving it away? I noticed you were trying not to give too much of the story away.
Right, but you're talking about Wonder of the Worlds now, right?
Yes. We're going to start there, then we'll move on to the other ones.
Okay, the first novel, Wonder of the Worlds, begins with a prologue. And it starts out in 1943 in New York City, and it dramatizes how Nikola Tesla died. And there's a lot of different legends and rumors that when Nikola Tesla died, the FBI or some secret government organization came in and took secret papers from his apartment and secreted them away somewhere to some facility. And since then, they've been using those in black projects. So that's the legend, that's the rumors, and there's a lot of different versions I've read about what actually happened the day he died, and, you know, who was called when, what happened, what did they take away.
Right. When did he die? It was 1941, was it?
1943.
43. Oh, my God, what a perfect time for all this information to suddenly be secreted away with in the view of certain people.
Right. Well, it was January 1943. Now, there's a number of people who connect Tesla to the Philadelphia experiment.
Right.
And we know that the thing with Allende was supposedly to happen in October 1943. So the story goes that sometime before Tesla died, he was involved with the Philadelphia experiment, and then he quit, and then they used his ideas after he died and developed it, and that was what Allende saw. And I always, when I first learned about that, I thought, well, that's a bit of a stretch. I know he invented alternating current, and he did some fantastic things, but I had a lot of skepticism about the Philadelphia experiment. But the more I looked at it, the more information that came out about it, there's been some good books out about it, you know, that starting with William Moore. He wrote the most famous one, you know, we know that. And up to today, I think the very best one is the one written by Joseph Farrell. And when you look at all that information, there's definitely something going on there. And what does it look like? It looks like they're using Tesla's ideas very clearly. So whether or not he was actually involved with it or they're just using his ideas, there's some kind of involvement with Tesla there. So that is definitely in my novel. And I don't want to give too much away in the third novel, but I'll just say I'm going to give the reader a feel of what it might have been like if Tesla really was involved with that project. And it's hinted at in The First Wonder of the Worlds, where he's talking about working on this switching system. What is that switching system all about? And you begin to get a little bit of idea about it as the novel progresses, because after Tesla dies, January 1943, the FBI comes in, they take all these materials out of his safe, and they start looking at them, and they realize they really got something. You know, there's all kinds of schematics and various airship drawings, and then they come across this manuscript that's typed. It's in pristine condition, and it's written in a first-person narrative, and they start looking at it, and it looks like it's something that was written by Mark Twain. So they go to a scholar of Mark Twain, and they ask him to read this manuscript. And so this professor of literature begins to read the manuscript, and this is where the main story of Wonder of the Worlds unfolds. The manuscript takes us back in a first-person narrative by Mark Twain himself to the Columbian Exposition of 1893, and it tells us what happened when he was there. It tells us all about Nikola Tesla and the adventure that transpired between Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla. And so why was Mark Twain in Chicago at that time? Well, he was nearly on the verge of bankruptcy. This was right before the big bank crash of 1893, which did wipe him out and just about everybody else. But he was, at that point, heavily invested in the Page typesetter. This was the competitor to the Linotype.
Mm-hmm.
And the way Mark Twain got interested in it, he lived in Hartford, Connecticut. And Page was developing the typesetter at the Colt Arms manufacturing plant downtown. And Mark Twain got wind of it. This was years before 1893. This was back in the 1880s. And Mark Twain loved to invest in things. He was always trying to find something to invest in. When he was a riverboat pilot, he invested in produce and eggs and such and sold that stuff. So he was always trying to think up some kind of business proposition. It even goes back before he was a riverboat pilot. The way he became a riverboat pilot, he went down to New Orleans on a riverboat, and he was going to take a ship down to South America to harvest coca leaves.
Huh?
and he was going to bring those back to America and sell coca leaves to people. He thought he was going to get rich doing that, and he found out there weren't even any ships leaving for South America out of New Orleans. So he fell back on plan B, which was to try to become a riverboat pilot. So he was always trying to invest in things. So he got into invest in the page typesetter. And the only thing he didn't invest in was the telephone, and he kicked himself for years for not investing in Bell's telephone. And the other thing was Nikola Tesla's alternating current system. He didn't invest in that because by then, when that came out, he was already heavily invested in the typesetter. But the typesetter was his undoing. He had a publishing company that also was not doing well, and he was going bankrupt from that. But the typesetter, that really was the straw that broke the camel's back. So he's in Chicago trying to get this typesetter, this whole business going. He's trying to get investors for the business. He's trying to get the inventor, James Page, to put this typesetter together and make it work. This is all just pure historical fact. This all actually happened. So this is the way the novel starts, in known historical reality, very particularly real. And then it takes off from there when Nikola Tesla comes to visit Mark Twain and takes him at night to see something very secret. And a person shows up, a very surprising figure, to go with them, and that is President Grover Cleveland, who Mark Twain actually knew quite a long time. Mark Twain knew Grover Cleveland way back when Twain was the editor of the Buffalo Express and Cleveland was the sheriff of Buffalo. So they had a pretty long relationship there. Mark Twain became Grover Cleveland's political supporter quite publicly. So this is a real relationship. And so it's not too far-fetched that this might have actually happened, because Grover Cleveland actually was at the fair on May 1st of that year to inaugurate it, to turn on Tesla's lighting system.
Mm-hmm.
So in the story, Grover Cleveland secretly has snuck into town, and he's there with Tesla to show Mark Twain something. And they go down to the south part of Chicago, out on a dock to a warehouse right on Lake Michigan, and in that warehouse, Mark Twain sees a gigantic airship that Tesla has had built. This is the way the story begins, with Mark Twain and Nikola Tesla and Grover Cleveland taking a ride on this airship over moonlit Lake Michigan. And while they're doing this, who's up on the rooftop of the warehouse? Spying this all out, two newspaper reporters who followed them there because they, Lily West knows something's going on big in Chicago. She's gotten wind that Grover Cleveland's coming to town secretly. She's got some contacts, and she's posted down there in the lobby of the hotel where Mark Twain was staying, and she follows Mark Twain and Tesla and Cleveland to this warehouse, and of course George Ade, who knows Lily West very well, and he's also working all the lobbies of all the hotels in downtown Chicago, as the reporters did at that time. He's following her. And so the story begins with the reporters seeing this airship and Twain and Tesla and Cleveland flying out over Lake Michigan, and there in midair they encounter a mysterious object that speeds by them. It turns out to be an airship from Mars. And so that's kind of the Act One curtain of Wonder of the Worlds. How did I do, Greg? Did that...
Oh, no, that's, you know what? That's perfect. At first, I was like, well, I told you to describe it. You're going to give away the whole thing. But no, you didn't. Mm-hmm. You see, that makes anybody that's listening really want to, you know, if they know about these subjects and are interested in them,
right,
even in the smallest amount, just to see how you play with the ideas and the personalities, and very important, I think the character of the time, the turn of the century, Belle Epoque, whatever you want to call it, is also
right,
a character as well, and it very much shapes the story.
By no means have I given the whole story away.
No.
But that is the that kind of sets it up for the readers. You know, if they're interested in the novel, you know, I think that should give them an idea what the story is like, and if they like adventure stories or science fiction, action adventure stories, there's a lot of that here for them. But as I said, there's a lot more to this novel, and I hope that I've captured the characters, because to me, the main thing in writing fiction is to create living, breathing characters. And if you can get into the story and start feeling like these are real people, and I can really see their individuality and feel it, then you're going to be interested in the story. You know, it's going to be entertaining. And that's number one in writing fiction. You've got to be entertaining. So I think that's the thing I feel the best about the novel. I feel that these characters do come alive. And I think the reason that is so is because I spent so many years thinking about these people. You know, before I wrote the novel, I really knew Mark Twain. And then it was 1991, I discovered Tesla, and it was well over a decade before I even started to think about writing the novel. So during that time, I was reading a lot about Tesla, thinking a lot about him, and reading a lot of other things that I began to understand dovetailed into what Tesla was doing and thinking, his way of looking at science and reality. And so I really understood him, I think. In some ways, I think I understand Tesla better than a lot of the people out there who are so into Tesla. There's a lot of people who are into the Tesla technology, or they're into various kinds of technology that they identify with Tesla in some way. And I found those people really, they don't seem to be interested in my novel, per se. They have their own view of Tesla, and a lot of them even feel somehow that it's an effrontery, or it's, there's something wrong about dealing with these ideas in a fictional form. They want to do the technology, they want to do the research, and they see what I'm doing as diversionary. You know, oh, people already don't take it seriously. Now you're writing the science fiction stuff, and they're really not going to take it seriously. But I have to say, there are a few out there that, like Frank Germano, I've noticed, you know, he's into this Tesla technology, and, you know, he said some really nice things about my novel. So in terms of it being realistic, you know, the background on Tesla's various machines and all that, you know, I did try to make it accurate, you know, for what I understand about what Tesla was doing. I'm not a scientist. I'm not a technologist. But I am interested in these things as a layman, and it took a number of years for me to figure out exactly what Tesla was doing. At first I thought that the very first thing I saw about Tesla was in a magazine, like a UFO magazine. There was a picture of the Wardenclyffe Tower, and I thought, this is just something somebody made up, because if it were real, I would have heard of this Nikola Tesla many years ago in school, like Marconi or Edison, you know, and right. Obviously I've never heard of him. Can't be real, but you know, then I read a little bit more about him, and I found out, no, this guy was real, and if that's so, and he did this and that, the next thing, then it means that he was intentionally suppressed. So I got really interested at that point, and I really started trying to educate myself about Tesla and about his technology and his philosophies, and I feel that I have a good layman's grasp of his ideas, and I've read, you know, there's people like Joseph Farrell who has written on Tesla, and of course he's got a much more scientist view of the whole thing, and Bearden, Lieutenant Colonel Bearden, you know, wrote all about it. People who are into this, they know all these people, and they know what I'm talking about.
Right, Tom Bearden.
But I think you can have you can understand something and still not be a scientist. I mean, you know, people understand how ordinary electricity works. They have a basic understanding how their automobile works, and they know that's real. Well, I have that understanding of Tesla. I know what he was doing. And then the other thing is, I know some things that he was doing, these three experts just mentioned, have not been aware of, because I've done some of my own original research into ley lines, and I found that this dovetails into what Tesla was doing. And this is where the handprint of Atlas comes in, where I talk about that in detail. I have a whole chapter on Nikola Tesla and the handprint of Atlas. So, in fact, what happened was in the late 1990s, in studying Tesla, a light came on, and I realized that what he was doing connected directly to what I had already been studying for several years. I don't know if you want me to go into that, Greg, or...
Yeah, I would like to go into it. I had a couple questions come up
while
you were speaking.
You
notice the style of this show is, if somebody's saying something interesting, I'm just going to let them go. I don't come in and interrupt unless, you know,
sure.
I think it's going on too long, whatever. It kind of interested me that you said you got to know Tesla to the point where, you know, you almost felt like you knew him.
Yes,
his personality and what made him tick. And not many people talk about that. I'd like to know what you think. What kind of person was he? What drove him? You know, he came to this country from Eastern Europe. He emigrated here, emigrated from Eastern Europe, and started working with Thomas Edison until Edison basically disillusioned him, and he went off on his own, which is probably one of the best things that ever happened to him. But
true.
You know, what kind of, you know, could you describe for us what kind of person you think that Tesla was? What made him tick? What was his motivation? And, you know, what did he hope to achieve? What kind of, you know, what kind of person was he?
Well, this would really blow people away, but Tesla had a great deal of love in his heart. They might say, "Wow, what are you talking about?" Because he never got married. He never, he had almost no relationship with women whatsoever, and they've made a big thing out of that. But if you really see, one thing about the reason I feel that I do know Tesla is that, first of all, I knew Mark Twain, and in studying Mark Twain, I studied all the people that he knew, and I got to know them too, like his family, like his wife, his daughters, his neighbors, his friends, you know, W.D. Howells, the writer, and then the industrialists that knew him, Andrew Carnegie, and all of these people. He knew a lot of people. He knew just about everybody. But he had a lot to say about these people he knew. He never wrote about Tesla at all. That's part of the suppression, by the way.
Yeah.
But I got a sense of the people as Mark Twain saw them. And I kind of got a sense also of the kind of people that were his friends. You know, people that were his friends in California, people like Bret Hart, who he had a falling out with later, and people back in the East that he was friends with, you know, like Joe Twitchell, his pastor. I put the pastor in quotes, you know, because Mark Twain was not really into Christianity. He came out of that as a child, and he definitely played the game when he first married his wife, and his wife's family, they were religious, but he really was an agnostic, or maybe even an atheist. In his later years, he was almost a metaphysical thinker. You know, he was experimenting with trying to understand with reality as a philosopher, and he was asking a lot of questions. And one of the books Mark Twain wrote was The Mysterious Stranger. It's set over in Europe in the Middle Ages, and it's about some boys who encounter this mysterious character who apparently has magical powers. He can just make things out of nothing, and then he can just destroy them. And he wrote several versions of Mysterious Stranger over a number of years. The interesting thing I found out later on, after I got to studying Tesla, was that I'd read The Mysterious Stranger years before I had knew anything about Tesla. And I didn't even connect it completely, but in the back of my mind, I think I did kind of pick up on it. But when I found this out, I said, absolutely. I see the whole thing. And what it was, The Mysterious Stranger is based on Nikola Tesla. It is based on Nikola Tesla's childhood. And if you read Nikola Tesla's biography and how he had these strange experiences of seeing three-dimensional objects he could remember, you know, like if you said dog, he would see a dog in three dimensions in color. And if you think about that, that's kind of like creating something out of nothing to have this experience of just thinking about something and it appearing before your eyes. You know, he took it for granted because it always happened to him as a child, and it happened to his brother. But there's some other things I've read about Tesla that tends to suggest that perhaps he had some contact with some kind of intelligence that might not have been human as a child. And because of this, when you read Mysterious Stranger and just say, this is based on things Nikola Tesla told Mark Twain privately, and then you get it. You say, oh, I see. Nikola Tesla was a child who had extraordinary experiences and maybe even contact with non-human beings who showed him that reality is a little different than what we're taught in school. And then this man grows up, and all of these childhood experiences begin blossoming in his mind, and he learns how to use these powers in a practical way to make a living in the world and to better the world. And this is what happened with Tesla when he was working for the telephone companies of Europe. He was also working on the alternating current machine, and it was at that time that he invented it. And he invented it using, at least to some extent, a kind of paranormal ability to visualize. He didn't invent it in a linear way with, according to the classical idea of the scientific method. You know, he didn't do a little experiment and then, or frame a hypothesis and then do a little experiment and do a control study and, you know, the way they tell you in school. He just thought about the thing and waited, and then the thing would appear to him. The machine would appear to him floating before him like a hologram, full color, and the thing was working. And he could turn it around. He could walk around it in real time, and he could walk away from it or put it out of his mind and come back to it, and the thing would still be working in what today we call real time. In other words, it had been going, its process had been going on all that time. He wasn't looking at it. He comes back to it. It's just like a real object. And in doing that, he could do little improvements on it and change it and experiment with it in that way, so that when time came to actually build a working model, he knew the thing inside out. That's the way the alternating current system was created. And just think about that, that our whole technological society, that we go to school and they talk about the scientific method like it's the Holy Grail, and the very technological society that was supposed to be invented by this scientific method wasn't invented that way. It was invented by paranormal awareness with Tesla. And then, you know, I looked at other inventions, other inventors, and I began to see a pattern of very strange things going on. And what that was, it was that the scientific method, in most cases, was not being applied in these discoveries. It looked more like things were just kind of popping up suddenly. You know, if, it's kind of like an evolution, you know, where they talk about, punctuated evolution, you know, where it just discontinuously changes, you know.
Yeah, there's sudden unexplained changes without anything leading up to it as you would normally think.
Right. And so if you look at that in terms of the process of technological invention and the development of industry, the textbook model of that sociologically is that we have scientists using the scientific method, and they're gradually learning these things, and they're doing these various tests, and they're doing control studies and everything, and then, you know, they learn a little bit, and then there's a little bit of accident, serendipity, and they throw that in, and then, you know, you get a little new bit of knowledge. But it's not, doesn't really look that way, at least it doesn't look that way to me. It looks more like suddenly just planted into human activity. All of a sudden, here's something that works. Now, I'll give you an example of that. It's the telescope. Nobody knows where the telescope was invented, where it came from. It just suddenly started being used in Europe, you know, at a certain time. Certain people started using telescopes or using lenses, putting them in tubes. And, of course, it was developed gradually, and they made better telescopes. But the principle of the telescope just suddenly kind of was there. We don't know who invented it. Now, maybe somebody invented it. Maybe they used the scientific method. But it's an example of a kind of a mysterious, sudden appearance of an invention without knowing how it happened. And there are other things like that. And, you know, to bring them to mind, but I even look at Thomas Edison and the light bulb. People think that he invented the light bulb, but, you know, you can look back at the history of that, and you see that other people before him were experimenting with these evacuated globes, and they were doing things, trying to make electricity light up a bulb, and, you know, and this whole thing where he sits there and tries all these different types of filaments, you know, and he makes this long list. It's just a little bit too good, in my opinion. A little bit too, looks a little bit too much like it was staged that way, you see. And I just, in looking at some other things about Edison, we don't have time to go into, but I began to say, I think what was going on here, somebody already told him that carbon is the way to go, but he didn't want to let anybody know that somebody told him. So now we're going to stage some experiments in this trial and error method that he was so famous for. And we'll go through that first, and then we'll do the carbon thing and make that work. And I think that's the way the light bulb was invented. So what's going on here with technology is that it's being secretly seeded into humanity. What does that say about humanity? Well, some people would be offended by this, but it says we're not as smart as we think we are. And there's just mountains of evidence to support that supposition. The thing with Tesla, he was definitely an intelligent man. He was a genius. He could think scientifically. And he did think scientifically, and he did do experiments. So I don't want anybody to misunderstand me there. What I'm trying to say here is that essential key elements in his inventions, especially with alternating current, was the result of an aspect of paranormal consciousness, if I could use that term. And that in other instances throughout history that knowledge was being seeded perhaps in other ways. Just for example, let's say that there was an ancient civilization like Atlantis, and it had an archive of technological knowledge, and that archive has been kept secret for thousands of years, and there's somebody who could go into that archive and draw things out and then hand that to a selected individual at the right time. If you had a timetable for human development, then, you know, then what would happen? You could create the illusion that people were discovering things, and gradually technology was increasing and industry, and it was all happening by the people doing it themselves. Look at Leonardo da Vinci and the Codex Atlanticus. There's some interesting things about that book that led me to believe that what that book was and why it was called the Codex Atlanticus was that it was a book that Leonardo da Vinci used to copy drawings out of other books that were Atlantean documents given to him by, who knows, the Medicis. Where did they get it? Vatican Library, perhaps, or some other archive. Imagine some kind of library. He gets these materials on loan. He sits down. He draws copies to the best he can figure. And what's the whole thing with that? To stimulate human consciousness, to get people thinking about machines, and to kind of seed humanity with a certain mindset. And that was the function of that Codex Atlanticus, in my opinion. And there's one thing in that Codex Atlanticus that tends to support that. There's a page in it. It was found in the early part of the 20th century in the library. Where is that Atlanticus at? Is it in Paris? I can't remember now, but whatever the museum where it's contained, I think it was in the Paris library. But the curators found a page in that. It had been glued on the back, and they pulled the paper off, and they found that Leonardo had apparently drawn on the back of the paper. They'd never known that. It had been glued on there for centuries. And it was a drawing of a bicycle. It was a chain-driven bicycle. Are you familiar with that, Greg, that drawing?
Yeah, I've heard about this. Somebody just wrote in and said the Arabs invented the telescope. But the thing is, I wrote back to him, well, where did they get the inspiration for that? Although a telescope, all you need is two lenses. Somebody maybe was holding two lenses and looked. But the point, your point is well taken. The idea I had when you're mentioning this is that, and I was talking about this with a guest a couple weeks ago, that things that happen in the quote-unquote future may be a result of people who are like Tesla, who are gifted enough to see past some kind of time barrier and basically know what the end result is, and then kind of back engineer their way into the solution for that. That's just one other way of looking at it.
Yes, absolutely, that's very true. And you can also, I've talked about this lately with Walter Bosley. You can look at people who are idiot savants, and you know there's idiot savants who can figure out a prime number to a huge amount, and they can do it instantly without reasoning about it. And that is a kind of paranormal consciousness, what I'm talking about, where there's a direct knowing. And, you know, psychologists haven't even begun to address this, but I just wanted to say one thing real quick, the comment about the Arabs inventing the telescope. Well, yeah, that's the conventional wisdom. The problem with that is there is no documentation for it. It's simply something that's said. A lot of ideas came out of Arabia and the Middle East, and especially ideas associated with alchemy. And it certainly seems that lens making, glass making, especially colored glass making, it was a branch of alchemy. And so that, yes, I would say probably the Arabs were the ones who introduced it. But the question is, was it invented by the Arabs? There's no evidence of that. And when you look at other things, it looks more like it was something that was seeded. Now, I can give you another. Oh, I wanted to go back to the Codex Atlanticus real quick.
Okay,
on that.
Yeah. Go ahead.
That chain-driven bicycle, you're aware of that. But here's the interesting thing about that bicycle, and it's been written about in a number of books. The teeth on the chain are square. It's impossible for a chain-driven bicycle to operate with square teeth. And also, there are other things on that bicycle that are mechanical non sequiturs. The handlebars are fixed in position. There's things that just don't make any sense. And if you built a bicycle, a physical bicycle, following that drawing, it wouldn't operate. And yet, here's this amazing idea of a bicycle, a two-wheel vehicle with bars. What does that really look like? Well, if you look at it a little more, you'll see that it's not drawn with the style of Leonardo da Vinci. Somebody else drew that. Well, who could that be? Well, Leonardo had a number of assistants, and one of them was Salai. And it's believed that that drawing was made by Salai, Leonardo's assistant. Now, here's where it gets interesting. What would a boy looking at, let's say, a drawing of a chain-driven bicycle from some kind of Atlantean archive picture book, and he looks at that, and he's never seen a bicycle before in his life. He does not even know what it's for, what it is. He doesn't even understand that you get up on it and you use those bars to steer with. He doesn't know any of that. All he does, he sees a shape, and he does the best to his ability and observation to copy that picture literally, drawing the shapes. And so that's what he comes up with, and he sees the teeth and the chain, and he approximates it. He doesn't understand what they do or how it works. They just make them square. It's not important. You see, that explains all these non sequiturs. So that tends to show that these drawings came out of an archive of other drawings that had been copied, much like the Perry Rees map was a copy of another map. Okay, now there's another little example. Let me show you something else in history. Gregor Mendel is the father of modern genetics, and we know he did those pea experiments.
Right.
The problem with that whole thing with the pea experiments is that his data was too perfect. Sir Ronald Fisher said as much. He said, Gregor Mendel's data, it's too perfect. It looks fake. It was fake, I believe, because like Edison, where I think he already had the idea for carbon and the light bulb, I think Gregor Mendel already knew the laws of genetics because he got them from some secret archive of knowledge, and then he just simply set the thing up to look like he had done some experiments. And he set it up so well, it just made a textbook perfect to illustrate the idea that if you really look at it, you see, wait a minute, that's just too good, you know? Well, there's a lot of things like that. Now, I go into something in the handprint of Atlas about the California gold rush of 1849.
Ah, back to the books. Good. I, you know what? Let me mention that for people that are joining us, we're talking with Sesh Hari, yeah, who's the author of Wonder of the Worlds, Metamorphosis, and Handprint of Atlas. This is Kill Radio, Radio Mysterioso. We're not going to take a music break because I'm having too much fun listening to and talking with Sesh here. So go ahead, please. Sorry.
That's okay. So here is the Handprint of Atlas. Greg, did you read the book yet, or familiar with it at all?
Only familiar from talking with you about the ideas for it, I think, when you were writing it or just finishing it.
Right.
And this is not part of the fiction trilogy of War of the Worlds. This is a little bit different.
But it does relate to it. I kind of see it as a nonfiction companion to the novels, because a lot of the ideas in the novels I touch on are written about in Handprint of Atlas. So there's a definite connection here. And I think you saw my presentation at Laughlin, right? And you got a little bit of that, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So I didn't get into this thing about the gold rush of 1849 at Laughlin. There are really two big discoveries in the Handprint of Atlas. There's a lot of interesting information there because, you know, it represents say 20 years of research that I did on the subject of ley lines and geophysics, geomorphology. So there's a lot of material in this book. And in fact, I should say that I'm beginning to work on a revised edition of the book, even though it's hardly even come out yet, because I've got new material I need to deal with. And I want it in the book, so, you know, we're working on it, and I'm busy with the trilogy, and so it's going to get out eventually, but in any case, there are two ideas in the book that are really big, and one of them is the idea that the Earth's axis is artificial. When I say the Earth's axis, I mean its geographic axis upon which it spins, not the magnetic field axis, the magnetic north and south pole. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the north and south pole geographic, what the latitude and longitude lines are based upon. Everybody, including the mainstream scientists and those not mainstream, for that matter, believe that the Earth's axis of rotation is natural. But I'm convinced, from what I've studied for many years, that it's not natural, it's artificial. And it's very recent. It's only about 12 or 13,000 years old. And before that, it was in another position up there in Baffin Island area, the North Pole. And so that's the one big idea in the book. And the other one is the idea that the gold rush of 1849 was staged, that it was not the kind of eureka moment that the history books say that it was, you know, where, you know, according to history, what happened was John Sutter built Sutter's Fork here in Sacramento, and this is in Central California, and in the 1840s, he wanted to build a sawmill and start a lumber business, so he went up into the mountains, into the foothills, and he built a sawmill on the American River, and as soon as that sawmill was completed, James Marshall, who was his manager of the sawmill, Sutter's manager of the sawmill, one morning, walking through the tail race of the mill, checking it, he found a piece of gold glittering in the rocks, and he picked it up and took it into camp, and they started doing tests on it, and he went back to Sutter's Fort, and Sutter looked at the gold, and he got out the Encyclopedia Britannica, and they did a little acid test in the gold, and Sutter said, "This is gold, this is real, you know, let's keep this quiet." And of course, they didn't keep it quiet. Everybody in the whole world found out about it, and they came to California, and we had the gold rush of 1849. That's the official story. And what I uncovered, and I wrote about in the handprint of Atlas, is an unofficial story that I think is the truth. And the way it goes is, it starts with John C. Fremont, who in 1844, he was a lieutenant in the Topographical Corps, the Army Engineering Corps. And what he was doing, he was mapping the western United States.
Yeah.
And I describe in detail how Fremont probably had some secret information, some secret maps, and he knew exactly where the gold fields were at. And he came in and located the major gold trap on the American River, came down into Sacramento, and advised Sutter on the precise spot where to build the sawmill so that a few years later they could make this big theatrical play of discovering the gold. But it didn't happen that way. Everybody knew that gold was here. The Mexican government knew it was here. The Americans knew it. When I say the Mexican government, I mean people at high levels within the Mexican government knew it was here. And people in high levels of political power in the United States knew it was here. And in other places in the world, they knew it was here. And there are even very old maps from the 1600s showing the site of where the gold is at. And I have one of those in the handprint of Atlas. So this is another example how our history has been staged throughout the whole of human history. I'm not just talking about the last 100, 200 years, but rather our whole history has been staged. And it suggests that there is something non-human directing the course of human affairs in the background. So that's what Wonder of the Worlds is about, in a way, or that's a theme threaded through it, and it's the theme through all the trilogy. As the novels progress, you get to know a little bit more about this. You get to learn a little bit more about the ancient history of the Earth and how that interfaces with the present time. So Wonder of the Worlds is about Nikola Tesla's conflict with Mars. And we find that there is a civilization on Mars, and it's actually human beings like us that live up there. They're living underground on a planet that doesn't have any surface atmosphere, and they are on par with us technologically, more or less. And so that's the main storyline, Wonder of the Worlds. Now, the next novel is Metamorphosis. Would you like us to get into that now? Or?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Okay. So Metamorphosis is the second novel in the trilogy, and in that story, it begins with another prologue. It's the same mysterious figure that was in the first novel, the man who, I call him the blank-faced man. He might be an FBI agent, but actually he's not really FBI. He's with something called MJ7, and I'm sure most of your listeners have heard of Majestic 12 and MJ12. And the idea with this is that my fictional MJ7 is supposed to be the forerunner of MJ-12. You think, well, MJ-12 was something that happened in 1947 with the Roswell crash, and Harry Truman and his advisors created this organization. And in my fictional history, which might not be too fictional, the fact was that there was something like this before MJ-12, that the U.S. government secretly already knew about extraterrestrial life. At least they knew about Mars and human beings up there, and there was concern about that. So as far back as the 1890s, they were trying to deal with this, and they had things in place to deal with it. They had an interplanetary unit of the U.S. Army. And this is the way it is in Metamorphosis. You find out that the U.S. government has a unit in the U.S. Army. It's called the Interplanetary Unit. And their job is to deal with all matters pertaining to any kind of interaction with other civilizations coming here, interacting with American citizens or whatever. And that interplanetary unit, after the assassination of President McKinley, which in my story, President McKinley is assassinated by operatives under the control of Martians. After the assassination of President McKinley, the interplanetary unit split into two parts, and one's interplanetary unit, and the other one is MJ-7. And it's very intimately connected to Nikola Tesla and his technology and using that to fight the Martians. And in my storyline, the first president who creates MJ-7 is Teddy Roosevelt, and Nikola Tesla is one of the seven in the advisory group. So that's a little background on how I've kind of interfaced with the UFO legends, you know, the Majestic 12, and I've used that as MJ-7. And this blank-faced man is an agent of MJ-7, so he's gotten the manuscript back from the professor of English in the first novel, and who tells him, well, you know, it might be authentic. It might be a science fiction story that Mark Twain wrote, but I doubt it, you know, for this and that reason. And the MJ-7 agent, the blank-faced man, and his partner go away at the end of that first novel. So the second novel picks up right after that. What happens next? It opens with the MJ-7 agent in an underground laboratory, 1 mile underground, and he's working with a technician who's looking at this watch fob that he got from the professor. It's got a crystal on the end of it, and it's got some, that crystal has some very interesting properties to it. The technician's telling the MJ-7 agent that, well, this crystal, it's not ordinary, and it looks like something that Nikola Tesla made, because I've seen two of them in my lifetime, and both of them have monatomic gold embedded in them. And this one, on this watch fob that belonged to Mark Twain, it doesn't have any gold in it at all. But, you know, it doesn't make any sense, because that would be like building an expensive automobile and leaving out the engine. And he's looking at it, trying to make sense of it, and the MJ-7 agent saying, well, what does this mean? And the technician says something to the effect that, this could be something like the ignition switch on a time machine. It could have, the gold inside this crystal could have transported to another dimension, another time, and from there, this whole possibility of dimensional travel and time travel takes off, and we follow the blank-faced man to Indiana, where he encounters George Ade again. This is the reporter in the first novel, you remember. He's the young reporter in his 20s, just starting out.
Yeah.
And, you know, George Ade, we'll kind of come back to him, talk about him a little bit for a moment, because you said some things I really liked, that he was really a great writer, you know. Yeah, so true, you know, but nobody knows about that. And Mark Twain and W.D. Howells were big fans of George Ade. It's very ironic because George Ade was a big fan of theirs, and W.D. Howells discovered George Ade and told Mark Twain about him. But Mark Twain actually had already been reading George Ade. He was coming out in, he was a newspaper reporter originally, and his stories were being printed in the Chicago papers in installments. And this was in the 1890s, around the time of the World's Fair. And later on, George Ade went on to write novels, and he wrote a very entertaining novel called Artie. I highly recommend it to anybody who likes good fiction. It's very entertaining. And you could see a lot of writing technique and characterization that becomes very, very common in the 20th century and even in modern television sitcoms, situations and the kind of humor. It's very modern for its time. It's very innovative. And Artie is an office worker in downtown Chicago in the 1890s, and it's his whole story about his life, trying to find a girl of his dreams and trying to work at his job and, you know, just going through Chicago in the 1890s and having a great time living life and, you know, experiencing people. And it's very funny. You know, George Ade wrote that. He wrote a novel called Pink Marsh, and that's about an African-American who's the main character. And he's not a stereotype as they were written at that time. He's a real person. He was the first African-American character, I'd say maybe outside of Mark Twain's literature, where a white man wrote about an African-American man in a realistic way. And he didn't try to make him a gigantic hero. He didn't make him a ridiculous caricature. He made him a real person. He had flaws. He had virtues. And it's a good story. And you know, that's another one I recommend. And then he wrote a number of plays. He wrote The Sultan of Sulu, which was based upon George Ade's experiences in the Philippines. And that was a Broadway play. It was very successful at the time. And he also wrote The College Widow, another Broadway play. And that one is what all these football movies are based on in the 20th century. All these movies like Newt Rockne and all of that stuff, you know, that we take for granted today as old hat. The first sports football fictional story was written by George Ade, College Widow, at the turn of the century, and they had the whole story take place on stage, and they had all the action going on stage, and it was a very innovative stage set they used, but it was the plot line of trying to win the game and all that we're familiar with. He's the first one who did that. So he wrote a lot of these plays. They were very successful. He made a lot of money. And then he retired from really full-time writing about 1910 because he was immensely wealthy from having his plays syndicated. His books sold very well. He actually did what Jack London later was trying to do. Jack London had his Beauty Ranch. And I'm going to talk about Jack London in just a second here.
Yeah,
because
he's one of the main characters
in Metamorphosis.
Right.
But George Ade he bought a lot of farmland in Indiana, and he became a gentleman farmer. So that's the story of George Ade, and the MJ7 agent goes to him to talk to him about Mark Twain manuscript and this crystal, and he shows it to George Ade in his house, the blank faced man says, "Well, now you've been with MJ7 for many years." And yes, he had. In fact, he was the top agent of MJ7. He was the one who worked directly with the President of the United States on many projects, many secret projects. And so George Ade knows all about the blank faced man, but the blank faced man doesn't really know that much about George Ade. And the blank faced man's trying to get information because he's beginning to realize that even though he's part of MJ7 and he's an agent, he doesn't have a need to know certain things. That he's realizing that it's a lot more complicated, you know, that there are levels of knowing and a lot of different levels and different aspects of stories. You know, what was this watch fob all about? Was Tesla traveling through time or something? And George Ade won't tell him much, but finally he'll say, "Look, I'll give you a hint. There's one person who knew a lot about Tesla's work with time, and that was Harry Houdini." And the blank faced man says, "Well, Houdini's dead." And George Ade said, "Well, that's the report out, yes, but his brother is still alive. You need to talk to him." So then the blank faced man goes to Houdini's brother, who's still alive, and there you begin to find out that Houdini's brother, Theodore Hardeen, he knows a little bit about MJ7, and he's got a book that he's kept all these many years hidden away, and it's a secret diary belonging to his brother. And he gives it to the blank-faced man, and it's all about Houdini's secret work with various governments as an agent, and including his work with Nikola Tesla. So the blank-faced man takes that with him and departs on a plane for the western United States. But en route, he's in the plane with his partner, and he has this book locked to his wrists in a steel suitcase, and a few other people on board this plane, and it's a government plane, it's an MJ7 plane, they attack him. We find that they're double agents, and they want that Houdini journal. And there's a gigantic fight on board the plane. The blank-faced man's partner shot. The pilot is shot. The co-pilot is shot. Everybody on board is shot. And the blank-faced man's fighting for his life. He's shooting people. Well, finally, the blank-faced man's the only guy left alive. He's got to get out of that plane because it's about to crash into a mountain, and he has to jump. And he gets a parachute on, tears open the door, and is sucked out of the plane, pulls the cord. Unfortunately, the parachute doesn't quite work right, and the blank-faced man plummets to the ground and crashes into a forest. And there he's discovered in the middle of the night by an old man. The blank-faced man is now paralyzed from the neck down, and he can't talk. He can only move his eyes. And the old man takes the blank-faced man down the mountain to a little cabin. And there, the old man begins to go through that steel suitcase, and he finds Houdini's secret diary and opens it up and begins reading it. And that begins Metamorphosis, the story of Houdini's secret life as an agent of various governments, the United States, England, and particularly his work as an agent for Majestic 7. Because in this, we go back to Wonder of the Worlds, and we find out about what happened in Chicago in 1893, and it's the same story told from his point of view. We see how he became involved with MJ7, and then it goes forward from there, from the World's Fair of 1893 on into the 1890s, the late 1890s, the turn of the century, all the way up until 1915 and the Panama Pacific Exposition. And that is where the main story of Wonder of the Worlds begins. In 1950 in San Francisco, there, Harry Houdini, he's playing Oakland at the Orpheum Theater, and there he encounters Jack London. And the story goes from there with Houdini, Houdini's wife, Jack London, Jack London's wife, and the things that happened to them in San Francisco, in Oakland, and ultimately in Glen Ellen, California, where Jack London's Beauty Ranch was located. And it's a fantastic story, but a whole bunch of it is based on things that really happened. It's even more than Wonder of the Worlds. It's a tapestry of fiction and fact woven together to form one storyline. So you're going to be wondering even more. The more you know about Jack London, the more you know about Houdini, you're going to be wondering, which part of this story is fiction? Did this really happen, or is this made up, or did that really happen? Because some of these things in the story actually happen. They are, in fact, so historically accurate. They're just, you know, photographic accounts of things that really happen. And I go from that then into this fictional storyline that takes up all the things in Wonder of the Worlds. It weaves that in. And some of these things in Metamorphosis are so far out, the average reader will think, well, he made this up, or this part here is just absolute fantasy. You know, this is just so far out, it's just unbelievable. And an example of that is Ed Morrill. You will find out if you read the parts about Ed Morrill that this most fantastic, unbelievable part is actually some of the real stuff. This is pure California history. And you'll think that, well, this is just made up. No, this is a real story about Ed Morrill, the Star Rover. And it's the story of a man who Jack London got to know about 1913, a man who was criminal and who ended up in Folsom Prison in San Quentin, who had incredible adventures in the prison system even, and who had incredible paranormal experiences that turned his life around and actually made him a leading citizen. He became an advisor to the governor of Arizona on prison reform eventually. This is all true. This all actually happened. And it's integral to the story of Metamorphosis, which is about some very, very strange things. Astral travel, out-of-body travel, time travel, interdimensional travel. It's also about the bell. Probably a lot of your listeners know something about the bell, and you know, if they've read Nick Cook's book on what's the title of it, on anti-gravity,
The Hunt for Zero Point.
Yeah, The Hunt for Zero Point. He talks about the bell in that. Igor Witowski, who did all this original research over in Europe, and then Joseph Farrell, who wrote a number of books on the bell, who's an expert on it. And so you have the bell out here in alternative research literature written about in detail, and a lot of people know about it. And I have made it a major character, almost, you might call it. It's a major device in Metamorphosis, just like the master crystal was in Wonder of the Worlds, the crystal with the drawing the electrical energy out of the ether. In Metamorphosis, the bell is a device that was originally created by the Martians, and it was a gigantic object out in interplanetary space which Nikola Tesla destroyed in 1903 by firing a longitudinal beam of energy continuously at it for up to a couple of weeks until it was destroyed and exploded in outer space. There are elements even in this fantastic scenario that are based on some real history, because in, I think it was the summer of 1903, that Nikola Tesla put on an amazing display of electrical energy on Long Island when he activated the Wardenclyffe Tower, and people in Manhattan could see this auroral display of electrical energy, these exploding arcs into the sky going miles high. And this went on for days and days in 1903. And in my novel, Metamorphosis, I explain the fictional scenario is that Tesla's blowing that thing up in outer space, that object, it's shaped like a bell. And some of MJ7 believe that it's some kind of interplanetary space station. They don't really know what it is. Tesla has a better idea what it is. He knows it's not a space station. He knows it's something much, much worse. And we'll find out later in the novel what that was. But he blows that up in 1903. Well, in 1915, something like that is returned, and now it's on Earth. It's not very big, but it's out in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. It's off the coast of California. And, pardon?
I said, this is how we're hooking into the California history. Which is something, of course, I'm very interested in.
This is where George Ade comes back into the story at night when Jack London comes by the theater to pick up Harry Houdini, or comes by his hotel room to pick up Harry Houdini, and out in the car, Houdini gets into the car, and, well, there's George Ade, and he hasn't seen him in a very long time. So that relationship picks up in this next novel, and we see George Ade and Harry Houdini and Jack London there in 1915, and what happens when they encounter the bell under the floor of the Pacific Ocean off the coast of California in a secret submarine that is part of a secret fleet operated by MJ7. This submarine is it can fly through the air like an airship. It can go under the water. It can go into outer space. So it's an amphibian type of vehicle. It's a gigantic vehicle. It's much bigger than the airship in Wonder of the Worlds, and it's operated by the U.S. Navy secretly. They go out into the Pacific in this submarine. Harry Houdini, in a diving suit, goes down. He goes down to the floor of the Pacific to get close to this thing, to photograph it, to see what it is. And he circles around it, and he has some very odd experiences in photographing that. And this is where the story begins with Metamorphosis. What is this object? What is it doing there? Who put it there? Who's involved with it? What kind of object is it? And so all of these questions arise, and they're answered as the story progresses, because Harry Houdini, by photographing that thing, he's become entangled with it. And we find out that he actually, down there on the floor of the Pacific Ocean, near that bell, he actually slips into another dimension, an exact parallel dimension with the one that he's in. He switches places with another version of himself. you could say he reincarnates with him, with a parallel version of himself in a parallel reality. And this is what the story of Metamorphosis is about. Houdini has performed a metamorphosis with his own self in another reality. How does he get back? And what is Bell all about? What's going on there? So this is a story about parallel universes. It's about time travel. And it's about human mystery. I'm going to call it human mystery, and I think you just have to read the novel to know what I'm talking about. The mystery of human emotions and the human mind, and why are we here, and where are we going, and big questions that I'm not presuming to give any hard and fast answers to, but there are questions that are asked in the novel, and ideas are presented, and I'll leave it to the reader to see of what they can come up with when they read the novel. That's the way I like to work. You know, I like the reader to bring something to the novel themselves. So,
yeah, well, that's, you know, any good piece of creative art is basically, you know, if the artist has to explain what's going on, that kind of, it's kind of like collapsing the wave quantum physics. As soon as you collapse that wave by giving an explanation, you've closed off the, you know, anything that anybody else could be getting out of it, and something you might not even put into it that consciously anyway, which might be useful. And I hardly agree with people, you know, if people get mysterious about their work with audiences or with questions and all that, I actually applaud them for it, because I think they know what they're doing with that attitude. And the fact that you express that tells me that there's probably a lot of levels going on in this book that, one, you planned on, and two, maybe some you hadn't. And that's fine, too, and it's just another kind of an unknown way to go about solving a problem. Somebody had described this to me, too, about solving some sort of historical problem or a scientific problem, as we were talking about, and that was using inspiration to kind of divine an answer and then working backwards from that. And it sounds like you do a little bit of that too.
Right. Yes. Yes, it was. There's a lot of things in this novel that I didn't plan on, and the novel took some turns while I was writing it. Another thing I need to say is that I think this novel, Metamorphosis, is fairly unique. There's a lot of Houdini novels out there that have been written recently and in the last several years. And I've read a lot of them, and some of them are interesting, some are better than others. But I really feel that I have a handle on Houdini that none of these other writers have had. And I can't really say why I do think that, other than to say that I've had some very interesting experiences and leave it at that. But I have a connection to Houdini that I think is rather unique. And I think, like Tesla, I have an insight into his personality. And one of the strong points of Metamorphosis, and what I really tried to do, I tried to write a novel where the real Houdini, the personality of Houdini, is there. That this, I'm taking a historical person and trying to make it as authentic as possible, and then putting him in a what-if situation. And I think I've accomplished that here. And so if you were going to read Metamorphosis, I would say you're getting a feeling of actually going through this with the real Houdini. Not he's not the Tony Curtis Houdini, and he's not the Houdini of some of these other novels where I could tell a lot of these people writing these Houdini novels don't really know that much about Houdini, and they're just kind of, they're taking the little bit they know, and they're kind of projecting their own ideas onto it, and that's okay, you know, it's fiction, you know. But I just felt that I'd like to see a novel about the real Houdini, because the real Houdini is so much, he was so much interesting, more interesting than any of these fictional representations that I've seen. And my first knowledge of Houdini was the Tony Curtis movie. I saw it back in 1964 on television, and I didn't even know who Houdini was before then. And and I was absolutely fascinated by this whole thing. But I started reading about him, and the more I learned about him, I said, wow, they didn't even touch on how amazing this guy was, you know, because he just did so many things. And you know, they didn't touch upon his movie career. You know, he made movies, he wrote movies and produced and directed movies, and he invented things, and he worked with inventors. You know, the inventor of the gyroscope for airplanes was Montreville Wood, and Montreville Wood worked with Houdini on inventing his illusions, his escape illusions. So there's so many different facets of Houdini that people don't even hardly begin to know about, but they're coming out now, and there's been some very excellent biographies written on Houdini lately. And so I just thought I need to write this novel because I do have this insight into him, and he was a character in Wonder of the Worlds, and I'm presenting him as a young man in Wonder of the Worlds, almost a teenage boy who's about 19 years old there. In Metamorphosis, he's a 41-year-old man, but it's the same person. So I think it'll be interesting to readers to read Wonder of the Worlds and then go to Metamorphosis and see, well, how did this young man change, and what was he like in middle age? And that's one of the strong points of Metamorphosis. So, you know, there's a lot of interesting aspects to this novel. It's very rich. And it was the very nature of the subject matter. It challenged me to go in directions and to write in ways that I wouldn't have with some other subject, you know. So the subject matter inspired me, I'll say.
Right. You know, we didn't talk about Handprint of Atlas. Walter gave me a bunch of questions to give to you. You know, okay. What? I don't think I've gotten to one of them yet.
Okay. Well, let's switch to that, and let's see what we can do with the time we have left.
All right. One of his questions is, Metamorphosis is a darker novel in a lot of ways than Wonder of the Worlds. Was that intentional?
Yes, it was, because just the subject matter drove the style and the mood of the piece. And Harry Houdini had a lot of dark aspects to his personality. He was a very complex man, and he had a lot of bright aspects as well. I've gotten to know him pretty well over these many years, and so Metamorphosis reflects that complexity. And it is a dark novel, and yet it isn't a, I wouldn't say it's a morose novel. It is a novel of adventure. It's a novel of situations that put people in very demanding, challenging circumstances, you know. So it is darker, and it is very mysterious, but it's definitely a big, gigantic adventure, and it's the centerpiece of the whole trilogy. From Metamorphosis, we move to the next novel. I won't talk about it because I'm still in the process of finishing it up, but it will be quite different than either Wonder of the Worlds or Metamorphosis. And when all of them are finished, all of them together, we're going to put those into a single volume, and that's going to be very exciting, where people can just have the single volume, and it'll be fully illustrated, all three novels, and then they will get kind of the musical quality of this, how Wonder of the World starts, and it's very adventurous and historical, and then Metamorphosis, it gets very dark and mysterious, and then the last one will be quite something else, which I won't even begin to describe, but it's going to be very different. So there it is.
Okay. Let's see. Harry Houdini is... Oh, you know what? You talked about Houdini being in the second novel, but I don't think you mentioned that he's kind of like a central figure in Metamorphosis.
And he is the main character. I should mention that Tesla is also in Metamorphosis, and he has a very important role in it. But in Metamorphosis, Houdini takes center stage. He's telling the story in first person, what happened to him, and Jack London is a very important character in it. Ed Morrill is fairly important. All these are real people, but Nikola Tesla is very important. And you'll encounter Nikola Tesla in Metamorphosis. He's part of the adventure, definitely. And you're going to encounter the Tesla technology, and he's going to explain how the bell works in Metamorphosis. And those people who have read Joseph Farrell's books will find this very interesting. And some of the things Joseph Farrell wrote about in his books about the bell, a little bit of that, I anticipated it myself. In fact, I think I know a few things about the bell that other people don't, and it's in Metamorphosis. And I could even say one thing about the bell, if you want to go into it real quick.
Oh, of course.
You know,
always
give the example of this big thing that looks like a Stonehenge construction. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, the henge looking thing that's in Poland right now.
Right. Well, Walter Bosley and I were talking about this, and we're both agreed that hinge thing is not something designed to tether the bell to keep it flying off into outer space. What it is is the framework for a water reservoir. And you can see this very same structure in other places in Europe. It's exactly the same thing, but you could see that it's a water reservoir. That's what that thing is.
That's funny. Reservoir. They pointed that out on the UFO Hunter show, too, about that.
Oh, they did? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, and I had figured this out quite a while back so that it gave me the idea for the plot of Metamorphosis and the bell that it's underwater. And one of the things I believe about the bell was that some of the experiments were done with a chamber with the water inundating the chamber. The bell was in a water tank, basically. And they were using the water both to wash out the chamber, you know, the brine thing they talk about, where they're
right.
Washing the tiles and everything. So they're using that to wash the thing, and they're also, I think, they're using it to fill the chamber with water. Sometimes some of the versions of the experiment involve that. And so in Metamorphosis, I have the bell on the floor of the ocean, and it being inundated with or surrounded by water, it is part of what's making the thing work. It's using that water to create standing waves that transduce the energies from the level of molecular level of standing waves in the water. It's kind of a dampening agent, and then transducing up into acoustical and electrical standing waves. And so, and this kind of touches on some of the ideas about how the Great Pyramid might have operated with that sealed chamber, you know, that it was filled with gas. And why was it filled with gas? Because the gas was being used for its acoustical and electrical properties, but they were transducing those through various kinds of energy, through the mechanical, the acoustical, the electrical, et cetera, the atomic, whatever.
Yeah, and it kind of sounds like the research of who was the Austrian scientist who was doing research in vortexes and water?
Yeah, that was Victor Schauberger.
Schauberger, yeah. Yes.
Yeah, very much so. The same thing there. He's transducing. He was using water and transducing that energy into electricity and other forms of energy. And and then, as I understand it, the later models of what he was doing, they were just using electrical fields, using the geometry of the flowing water as an electrical field. So they weren't. They moved away from using water, as I understand it. But I don't think they really understood his ideas, because he was making things, making energy devices that operated on vortex-shaped configuration of moving water, and that would actually itself create energy. And there would always be an electrical or electromagnetic component to that. So that's what I thought they were doing with the bell, you know, and so I worked that into my novel. So in any case, I have Tesla talking about some of this and explaining it to his assistant, how the thing works and why it's made the way it is. And so I think people will find that a little bit interesting.
You know what? Another of Walter's questions, which fascinates me, and I didn't even know you had done any research on this, He asked if you could elaborate on your theory about Amelia Earhart's disappearance.
Oh, okay. That does get into the third novel. Okay.
Obviously, he's seen the third novel, or some of it.
Yeah, he knows something about the third novel. I've talked to him about it. I guess I could say this much, that the third novel does involve Amelia Earhart. And, of course, there's been a lot of theories about it over the years. And, you know, if you went back 20 years ago, most writers would kind of poo-poo the idea that Amelia Earhart's flight was anything other than what it seemed to be, and that she just probably crashed into the ocean. That was the mainstream view. Or maybe she did land on an island and, you know, and maybe the Japanese captured her and something happened there. But most likely, you know, she just crashed, you know. But there's been a lot of books since then, especially in the early part of the 21st century, coming out, people doing good research. I'm pretty well convinced that Amelia Earhart was a secret agent for the United States government. She was actually a commissioned officer in the United States Army Air Force, and that it was a very long-term, long-range plan, parts of it set in place long before Amelia Earhart was even famous as a woman flyer or very well known. The real turning point for Amelia Earhart was in about 1929, when she was discovered by G.P. Putnam of the Putnam Publishing Company.
Yeah.
He had just recently published Charles Lindbergh's biography, his story of his historic flight across the Atlantic. And now they were looking for someone like a Lady Lindy, you know, a woman Lindbergh, who they could promote, who would be a flyer, and they could get this woman to write books and lecture, and they could generate income from this. And so G.P. Putnam was looking for this woman to cast her like a character in a play, and they found Amelia Earhart. She had all the qualifications. She was a woman flyer, and she had worked for the Red Cross and done various things that showed that she was an educated woman of culture, intelligence, and also a pilot. And that's what they wanted. Perfect person at Bill. And so they contacted her, and basically she said, yes, I'll do this. I'll fly across the Atlantic. First woman to fly across the Atlantic. All she did, she was just a passenger on this plane that was flown by two men. But that began her career, and from then on she started breaking records and all that everybody knows about. But I suspect that this plan that Amelia Earhart became involved with was already in the war game stage way back in the 1920s. And one of the aspects that makes me think that is the airplane Electra that was built by Lockheed, that the very name Electra refers to the Pleiad, the seven sisters of the Pleiad constellation, the Pleiades. And Electra was the lost star in that myth, and so it indicates that already they had a code name made up for the idea of using an airplane with a woman in it who would get lost. And, you know, the plan would be that this woman would currently be a civilian flyer trying to break a record. She'd fly around the world, and then she'd get lost. And then the U.S. Navy would have to go out and look for her, right? And in the process of looking for her, they could also see all these islands in the South Pacific and see, well, what do you know? There's a bunch of Japanese ships out here, and look, they're building wharves and they're building infrastructure. And we're just looking for a lost lady flyer.
Yeah, they did this in Mexico too. Apparently,
theory that this is what Amelia Earhart was doing, including her husband G.P. Putnam, After she was lost, he actually promoted this idea, and in the early 1940s, they made a movie about Bowman Flyer, who was a secret agent who flew over the South Pacific and who intentionally got lost. And this was created by G.P. Putnam. This was a screenplay he and another guy put together, you know, and this is what he believed that his wife was involved with. And I think he knew a whole bunch more than even went into this fictional storyline. But, you know, after that, people tended to discount it because, and it probably had something to do with the government itself. You can imagine if that was a secret project, they wouldn't want people to know about it. They're not going to admit to it. And so it's only natural that they would say there's nothing to that, and there would be people who would come forward and say, no, that's silly, nothing happened like that. But, you know, if you look at all the historical information, and especially the material that's come out in the last few years through the Freedom of Information Act, yeah, it's pretty well clear that Amelia Earhart was trained by the U.S. Army, and that there were several versions of the Lockheed Electra built, and the plane she actually used was a spy plane designed to take photographs and do reconnaissance. And what happened to her, probably, I think, she was shot down by Japanese fighters. And the best information shows that her wing was damaged, but she managed to land the plane on an atoll, and she was picked up a few days later by a Japanese ship. And in fact, it's come out that there was radio transmission where she even described the officer approaching on the boat, you know, when they're approaching in the shore boat, and So she was captured by the Japanese. Where she was taken is unclear, but she was taken to one of the islands by the Japanese and probably died in captivity, as well as her navigator, Fred Noonan. They probably both died in captivity, I believe. There's a lot of different legends about that. There's Amelia Earhart's mother suspected that her daughter might still be alive at the end of the war. There was a strange cable that was sent to G.P. Putnam, Amelia Earhart's husband, from China, I believe, at the end of the war, where a prison camp was liberated, saying, you know, I'm coming home and, you know, give my love to mother, etc. It's hard to say what that telegram was really all about. Was it some kind of subtle, complicated disinformation of the intelligence agencies, or was it a real cable from Amelia Earhart? I don't know if we'll ever know that. And there was also this controversy some years ago about some people believed a woman living in the East Coast of the United States was Amelia Earhart with a changed name and identity, and she actually had to go to the courts to get people to leave her alone and to prove that she was not Amelia Earhart. So there's all these legends around what happened to Amelia Earhart, and I think pretty much she was captured by the Japanese. But I use that in the third novel, those unknown aspects to the whole mystery, and I present a much more fantastic possibility about what happened. And it connects perfectly with Metamorphosis, what's happening in 1915. You will see that everything that happened in 1915 dovetails precisely with what happened with Amelia Earhart. And there's some very interesting coincidences about Amelia Earhart that I started discovering the moment I said, well, I'll write the third novel, and Amelia Earhart's going to figure in this, discovering about, for example, George Ade. You know, his alma mater was what? Purdue University. And where was Amelia Earhart right before she went on this world flight? She was the woman's counselor at Purdue University. And they have a great aeronautical department there that was goes back to 1910. And who created that aeronautical department? Well, one of the people that, one of the key people involved with creating the aeronautical department for Purdue University was George Ade. It's very interesting, doesn't it? And then, you know, you look into the, even later times, who else came out of Purdue University? Well, some interesting people, astronauts like Neil Armstrong, the first man on the moon. So what is it with Purdue University? I don't know, but I'm certainly using it in my story. And so you, if you read the third novel, you'll see all that, and you'll see a possible explanation of what happened to Amelia Earhart, what really did happen to her. That's it, Greg.
Okay. There was one. The next show hasn't come in yet, so we have time for one other question.
Okay.
Walter also asked if there's going to. He probably already knows the answer to this, right? Will there be another novel, another Sacheri novel after Wonder of the World, after the trilogy is finished?
Oh yes, I have a lot of ships in the shipyard that are being built mentally. You know. I think about them a lot as I'm writing these other novels, and by the time I get to them, they'll already be well on their way. I have some great ideas in store. So, yes, there's going to be a lot of Sacheri novels, and it would be nice if somebody read them.
Also asked if you found some resistance to your ideas, you know, from in other interviews you've done or articles, any kind of media exposure.
There's been some very, very strange resistance, and I've found there's a pattern with what I'm doing. You know, Walter Bosley is the publisher of my novels, and not only that, he's functioned in an absolutely fantastic way as kind of an agent for me and as a publicist, and he's gotten me the most amazing publicity, international publicity. I would have never believed that I could have gotten it or gotten it the way he went about it. But, you know, I've been, as you know, I was in 40 in Times, the UK magazine. You know, they had a big article, and you were in it, you know, about the Laughlin thing. And I was featured at the Tesla, International Tesla Society's convention in Switzerland for his 150th anniversary. And you know, there's been a lot of stuff, you know. I've had a lot of publicity and interest, and I've done a lot of radio shows, but there's a pattern there. It seems that there will be an initial interest, and then the people will pull back, and they won't be interested. You know, it's like something begins to happen, and then they pull back. You know, well, what's going on there? I don't know. I don't know if it's part of this suppression of Nikola Tesla, or something else that I've done. But in any case, there's something like that going on. But I'm just continuing doing the writing. You know, I'm just doing the writing, and hopefully people will begin to recognize it. There's been some odd things going on in Amazon.com. I think you know about that. You know, I don't know if it's common for small press publications to go on Amazon.com and be sold for, you know, $100 or $150, you know.
Yeah, I pointed that out to Walter. I saw that about, I don't know, 3 weeks ago. I just looked up Wonder of the Worlds, and people were selling it for $80 or $100.
Yeah. Now, I don't know anything about selling books like that. Maybe this is a common thing. Maybe you know something about it, but it seems kind of weird to me. And not only is Wonder of the Worlds being sold, but now, also, this is really getting strange, Handprint of Atlas is being sold. It's hardly come out. There's only a few copies of it in circulation, and it's up there being sold, too. Also, Metamorphosis is being sold. So, you know, we're still, Walter and I are still in the process of working out all the bugs with the books. You know, we're in the process of getting the printing just perfect, and as I said, even Handprint of Atlas, I'm seriously working on a revised edition. There's going to be some more material to go into that. And here's the books up on Amazon.com selling, you know. Well, in any case, I do think there are some people who are interested in what I'm writing and people who are in the know, and maybe that's part of it, you know. But there are some, I've done original research, and there's information in my books you just can't get anywhere else. And I've been helping Walter. He's got a fantastic project that we can't talk about now, but it's going to blow people away when they when it finally comes out. And
yeah, he's been talking about it.
Help on that.
He's been giving me regular updates, and I've actually gone out on a few of his expeditions and looked at some of the stuff.
Yes, and it's getting more and more interesting all the time, and you know we're finding some very interesting things. So, and I'm continuing my own research, my own personal research into the fantastic. You know, I've been involved with the fantastic all my life. I've had contact with non-human beings. People don't believe that often when I tell them that. I don't go around telling people I know or I'm slightly acquainted with any of this, but I have gone, as you know, I've gone to UFO conferences or paranormal conferences, alternative research conferences, and I've talked about this, as many people do. I found that it's interesting, there's a lot of skepticism about it. If you tell people, and I'm talking about people who are into UFOs or believe in UFOs, if you tell them a version of your experience that correlates with their own belief system, they will believe you. But if you tell them what actually happened to you, they don't want to hear it. They did not want to hear what happened to me at Laughlin. They did not want to see that picture of the entity I encountered when I was 6 years old, because the thing looks ridiculous, and people were laughing. And, you know, I'm well aware that thing looks ridiculous. That's one of the aspects of the real beings. They're not like the stuff you see in the UFO books, because a lot of that stuff is not accurately portrayed anyway. It's the artist's idea of the thing. And they're kind of, you know, they're doing something that they're putting their own belief system into the drawing. So it reminds me of the thing about the Vermeer paintings, you know, that came out in the 30s, and people thought they were real Vermeers, art experts, and then a few years later, it suddenly popped out at them, and they said, wow, those are fakes, because that woman in that Vermeer painting looks like Greta Garbo, you know, but they were so immersed in the culture of the 1930s, it was invisible to them. Well, that's the way it is with these UFO representations, you know, that people are unintentionally putting their own perspectives and beliefs into these representations. Now, you take somebody like me, I've got a little bit of illustrating ability, and I'm going to present the thing as accurately as I can from my own personal experience without trying to judge it and trying to second guess or do an analytical overlay to say this is an outer space being from Zeta Reticuli or whatever. I don't know where these things came from. I strongly suspect that they weren't from another star system, as people believe, or at least it's not a simple explanation like that. They're more like an interdimensional type of being, but they're definitely not human, and they're definitely they have heightened psychic ability. They communicate not with words but with thoughts. But at Laughlin, you know, the people didn't want to see that, and then they didn't want to hear what I had to say about the abduction phenomenon. They wanted to believe that the ETs are nice, warm, and fuzzy, and it offended them, and so people walked out on what I was saying. People were derisively laughing at me and all that. Well, when I had those experiences as a child, I always said to myself, someday I'm going to tell somebody. And that's what I was doing at Laughlin, doing other places, and doing right now.
Right.
You know, I promised myself I'll remember this, and I will tell people in the future. So, you know, people like me do speak out. You know, Travis Walton, he was telling it pretty much as it was for him, and it's a hard thing to do, but there comes a point if you are somebody like me who wants to be a media person or a writer or an artist, you can't do it honestly and leave that part of the story out. You've got to put it in, and that's what I've done. And it's a story that it's all of our stories, because these beings have interacted with us for thousands of years, and they are a part of us, literally. They're a genetic part of us.
Yeah, well, I've written this. I've written something along the same lines on my on the blog there that I do with Nick. And I, you know, it's Carla Turner said something to me when I interviewed her, and I printed this, which was some of the answers are going to come out of the stuff that doesn't seem to fit, the stuff that doesn't seem to, you know, the anomalous stuff is where she thought some of the answers would come. The, you know, Sesh, the next show is in here, and we're just on a great thread here, and I'd like to continue it if you'd like to come back at some point.
Absolutely. I can come back sometime.
Okay.
That'd be great.
Well, thanks so much for coming on with us here, and mind-blowing stuff and stuff that really interests me. And like I said, Wonder of the Worlds, Metamorphosis, those two novels have a lot going on in them. Even if you don't agree with what is being done with it, you have to look at some of the messages, the versions of history, methods of control, and secrets that are there for everybody to find if they're willing to look. So,
right.
You know, in that light, I think that, you know, if nothing else, those two novels and the next one are required reading for people, at least that listen to this show, and probably most of the population. But
thank you, Greg. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks so much for coming on, and we'd love to have you on again, and I'll get in touch with you either directly or through Walter. And we'll do this again before the end of the year, definitely.
Well, thank you for having me on. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thanks so much, Sesh. Talk to you soon.
Good night, Greg.
Good night. All right. That was Sesh Hari, author of Wonder of the Worlds, Metamorphosis, and Handprint of Atlas. There's a third novel in the Wonder of the Worlds trilogy coming out this fall, within a couple of months. Radio Antenna is here. He's been sitting here waiting very patiently for almost the last 10 minutes. We're going to let him on. I will not be here next week. I'll be in New Mexico at the ASPE conference giving a talk. But we'll be back 2 weeks from tonight, and I'll try to give updates on what's going on out there in New Mexico on UFO Mystic. So thanks for listening. It's Radio Mysterioso, and here's something I just downloaded by one of my favorite bands, which if you know me, you'll know who it is. Oh, I guess it's live.